Woo! Welcome to the Somewhere Called Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And I'm feeling the love over here on this Tuesday.
You're feeling the love in what way?
In the form of smart food popcorn.
Okay.
So this morning, bright and early in a snowstorm, we got a food grocery delivery to our house. And you ordered it and I opened it up and the first package was smart food popcorn. And I was like, this is ultra love right here.
I feel pretty bad because I didn't know it was going to snow when I ordered grocery delivery. So this person had to brave the conditions, go through the elements just to deliver this cheesy popcorn, because I know that's what you'd want with your rest day today, 2 days after your ultra.
I'm so excited. After this podcast, I'm going downstairs and I'm punching the cheesy popcorn. But I feel like the love makes up for last night, because last night before going to sleep, we've both been like pretty tired. And
Post-race.
It makes sense. We earned our fatigue.
Yeah.
I gave you the weakest sauce goodnight kiss ever. And so the popcorn is like really making up for that.
Yeah. I went in with my full body weight ready to really celebrate the weekend after we made it home here in Boulder after our race in Arizona. And you just gave me like 5 pecs. It was like a rock skipping across a lake, which is like, and that was all you could muster. What was up with that?
I needed to breathe between the pecs. Okay. I couldn't go. I was like, I just need to breathe over here. Yeah.
Well, so tonight I'm going to get that big kiss and it's just going to be filled with like cheesy breath, which honestly is probably the best for me too.
Yeah. It's true love. It's true post-ultra love.
Smart food backwash. So yeah, I mean, before we get to all the topics today, I just briefly wanted to touch on the big news, which is Megan is back, baby. We're going to get all into the 50K details, but second fastest time ever at this 50K. And my reflection was literally right before we recorded. It's actually kind of a mindfuck for me to get into this recording and, you know, being a little bit more humorous and energetic, because we watched a video that tons of listeners sent in after we made some jokes about gay country music and wanting more.
It's like, where is it? Yeah, I feel like there's so much lust. It needs to be there.
Yeah, it's so much lust.
All these women that like kind of like are, the men are like portraying like man-like characteristics on the women is like, you really just want a man. We all know it.
Well, so there's lots of gay country music we have learned. And in particular, people sent us the video to In Your Love by Tyler Childers. And it's beautiful. Go watch it right now. And we're watching this and it's a love story between two men, and one of them goes through health conditions. Don't want to give a spoiler. You're probably going to be able to guess what happens.
Okay. They're mining, and like, we're not going to spoil it. This is like early on in the video, one of them starts to cough and I was like, oh fuck, this is not good. This is some serious foreshadowing. Yeah.
They go down into the coal mines and it's like, oh, this isn't going to end well. Is it? They're not going to go to medical school after this. And so you can imagine it's basically the plot of The Notebook, which also made me cry. But so I'm just sitting there.
The Notebook made you cry?
Yeah.
We've never watched it together. Were you crying in high school alone?
In high school, at psychology class. We watched it for some reason in psychology. And so as I'm there, they're in the hospital in this video, and I'm just crying, thinking about being with you in the hospital when you're going through your heart condition, worried that you were not going to make it out of there or something really bad was going to happen. And so at this ultra, to see you cross that finish line against, you know, this race has been going on for 32 years, many of the best athletes ever, to run the second fastest time ever, to absolutely crush it beyond what I think you expected, but basically what I expected to the minute. And it's just such a cool moment of reflection. And I'm so proud of you, Megan.
Thank you. I'm kind of speechless right now because I truly did not expect it.
Yeah.
And I actually had this moment at mile 27 where I started to cry. And I was like, Megan, I thought I was going to run like a 4:45. Like, I actually hadn't even researched the course much. But the one thing I did know was that Ann Treason ran a 4:34. And I was like, there's no way. It's Ann Treason. Like, there's no way I'm going to run faster than that. And at mile 27, I started to do the math. And I was like, fuck. Like, this is actually turning out to be a performance that indicates that I am back. And I started to cry right there on the course. And I was like, Megan, hold your horses. You got to get that butt to the finish line. Yeah. So I like reined it back in. I was like, Megan, there's no crying during running. You can cry after running, but not during running. And it was just one of the, I mean, I truly don't think I ever thought I would be back to this level again. And I like, I don't know, I've gone through the process of like accepting that and having gratitude for getting to do this sport at all.
Yeah.
But I really do feel like I'm back now. And it's just like, it's cool. And you know, who knows, like who knows where this goes from here, to be back for one race and to be back and just like do it for myself is very cool. So
after what you've been through and just the ability to keep showing up, our podcast listeners understand they were there every single week through that. Even on the week that your heart first had its issues, we recorded an episode, and I don't know if like, I kept saying that you were going to be back there and this was going to happen, and for it to actually happen, I mean, I'm almost going to cry again. It's just incredible, Megan. It's just indicative of so much of your toughness and strength and grit at times when it would have been so easy to give up. And I'm just so inspired by you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I truly didn't expect it to happen, yeah, which is the wild part. So when it did happen, I was like, what is going on right now? This is so wild. And I do think it's a reflection is that I think some athletes race better than they train.
Yeah.
And so I actually, for myself, like, I feel like I'm a very, at this point in my coaching career, like I have a really good understanding of training trajectories, but sometimes athletes and sometimes even yourself break that. And I think there is a notion of like stepping up to race because it does give you that confidence. Yeah. And I don't think I mean, you listened to the podcast episode last week and you asked me at the end of the episode about the race. And I was like, well, you know, I'm just not myself. Yeah, like, yeah, we'll see what happens. This is going to be a journey. And it was just, it was truly wild to go out there and do that. And I'm like still emotional about it.
It was so incredible. Okay. So before we get to the episode, I want to reread a few lyrics from the song that apply to ultra running and what we just talked about. So this is from Tyler Childers from the chorus of that song. We were never made to run forever. We were just meant to go long enough to find what we were chasing after. I believe I found it here in your love.
That is beautiful. Also, go watch the music video, yes, because it's like, I feel like those lyrics encapsulate like 10% of it.
Yeah.
And the rest is in the music video. It's
watch
so good.
The music video, then watch The Notebook again.
Yeah.
And you'll realize, hey, this is beautiful, but I'm also being manipulated a little bit. Yeah. And for some reason, I like it a lot.
Also, it's training. It's so, yeah, that you can hold back your tears at mile 27 and get your butt to the finish line.
Also, before we get, it's really incredible what The Notebook actually was. Yeah. Ryan Gosling and Rachel McAdams became two of our best actors ever.
That's actually true. I mean, Ryan Gosling, like, women should have won awards from the Barbie movie. Like,
yeah,
Margot Robbie, like, you know,
Greta Gerwig,
they should have won awards. But you know what? Ryan Gosling was also pretty damn good.
He's so incredible.
He was so good.
So, okay, the big conclusion of the SWAT podcast is The Notebook is performance enhancing. All right, we have the best episode for you. We're actually going to start with the Barkley Marathons and history being made there. I want to get into that before some racing thoughts. Then 10 thoughts from the Crown King Scramble, a bunch of a mishmash of things that can help you out. A beautiful listener message about racing. Then a discussion about training for uphills and downhills. A new hot water immersion study that's fascinating. And then news and fun things, including shocking data on time-restricted eating. Stick around for that if you've ever been on the fence about that, because it is going to make you not want to do it.
Well, I love how you're teeing it up, because I actually think there's some scientific nuance that I would love to go in. I actually don't believe the data.
Nuance is unsexy.
Yes.
No more nuance.
I love,
Megan,
how you gave the headline, and I was like, that is not the headline I would give. I would say that's poor science.
Tyler Childers is in your love. Megan Roach is in your nuance.
Yeah.
Then we're going to talk about an NSAIDs and performance study, social media and athletics, some thoughts there, and whole lots more.
Okay, I am so excited to talk about Barkley. So
yes,
this happened on Friday. We actually recorded a Patreon episode after it happened and kind of went into some of like the nitty gritty. And I feel like Patreon is always fun because it's like very raw.
Yeah.
And it was just, I mean, seeing what Jasmine Paris just did at the Barkley Marathons, we're going to go into it in a second. It was one of the best ways to then wake up the next morning and go do, yeah, an ultra, because I mean, her inspiration and what she did, and also her like perseverance. I mean, it was not the first time that she went out and swung and yeah, like did the race. It was just so inspiring to line up the next day.
Yeah. So basically, let's take a step back. I think the Barkley Marathons is one of those events that has captured the imagination, but not everybody fully understands. This is essentially a 5-loop course. It involves a ton of navigation. It's not just ultra running. It's insanely steep, mostly off trail, through briar patches. Everyone's covered in these like 3-inch deep cuts. Honestly, everything about it looks miserable.
Okay, see, this is where we differ. I saw those cuts and the briars and the poles. Actually, somehow I saw the poles and I was like, sign me up for this race. the navigation, I get us lost, like,
yeah,
going to Whole Foods in Boulder, which we go to every night. But like,
Megan, I call bullshit, because the night before our race, our 50K, I just tried to show you the Strava. You refused to even glance at the map. Meanwhile, you're saying the Barkley Marathons, which requires master navigation skills, is something that you're intrigued by?
Well, I would want to. It's like stepping up into a new challenge. Uh-huh. I run best. We had like a little, we always have like a little bit of like pre-race friction on this.
Yeah.
I run best when I know nothing about the course. Uh-huh. When I just go out there and I soul run and I soul vibe. And every race you try to, you're like, Megan, dig into the nap, dig into the splits. And I'm like, nope.
Okay.
But for Barkley, I would, because you have to. It's different.
So you're saying you'd want to learn?
I would want to learn. I feel like navigation skills are extremely useful.
That's like me saying I'd want to learn how to give birth through my butthole. It's not going to happen.
You don't think it's possible?
It's not possible for you even a little bit.
Okay, maybe I'll prove you wrong.
Just like...
I mean, okay, I'm not going to do... I mean, to do what Jasmine, I think, yeah, actually our main conclusion, I think, is that there's one person who can do what Jasmine just did, and that's Jasmine.
Yeah.
But I do think it would be fun to try to learn more navigation skills for Barclay.
Yeah, I think there's talent in that area, just like there is in athletics. And sometimes we don't pay attention to the intellectual talents mm-hmm. as much as the physical ones, but that's what makes Jasmine so special. And so throughout history, there had been 17 finishers before this year of this race that had been going on for a very long time. It's essentially made to fail, to the point that on past year's episodes, I had speculated that a woman would never finish this race, and it made me feel skeptical about the race itself.
Actually, I love that you say that, because I always had challenges with the race. I'm like, if this is a male-centric race where men are going to be the ones who are always finishing,
yeah.
like what does that do to the level of women's inspiration?
Yeah.
But you know what? I was proven wrong.
Yeah, and I was proven wrong too. And I want to recognize that, because that is coming from a place of not being just a fully external evaluator of this. I've coached finishers of this race. I coached John Kelly. I coached Damian Hall. John Kelly finished this year. Damian almost finished, just had a little navigation issue in this final lap that prevented it. And seeing what they're capable of and understanding what it takes to just finish under the cutoff of 60 hours, I was like, this would require such a wild confluence of abilities for a female athlete that setting it up in that way almost feels sexist, which I was so wrong. In fact, I mean, if anything, I'm like, fuck, what are people capable of? What am I capable of if Jasmine can finish this race? Like, I'm just so mind blown even now that I think that 100 years from now, we're going to be talking about what Jasmine just did at this race. And I know that sounds weird, but this is beyond, even to me, something like the marathon world record. The marathon world record is going to get dropped a lot. I think for the next few decades, we're going to be talking about what Jasmine did in such hushed tones as to make it almost mythological.
And I love that you brought up this point too, because I almost feel like for her to be able to do this, and I think this is what I struggled with Barclay, is like, you know, women are capable, and we just saw Jasmine do something freaking incredible.
Yeah.
But testosterone is a hell of a drug. And I think it's almost interesting to think about the different percentages of skill that are required for a woman in particular at Barclay.
Yeah.
Just because like for someone like John Kelly or Damian Hall, there's more wiggle room in terms of the overall like amount of like strength and testosterone.
And margin for error in general.
More margin for error. And yeah. So for a woman to finish Barclay, I feel like it requires navigation skills that are much higher than men, because yeah. it's like the wiggle room, the error bars are like, you know, so much higher that it's like, it's really hard to like be able to do that without having insane navigation skills.
So for context here, I think sometimes the people that write off Barclay, which has been me to a certain extent in the past, in the sense of like, I uplift Western States, obviously, or a marathon world championships more than Barclay, because I'm like, well, it's a little bit insular. You have to figure out all of these entry details. It's all complicated stuff.
Like 40 people do it each year. Yeah.
It's not like that prominent who is actually doing it in the big scheme of athletic existence. And so it gets back to a question I often ask myself when trying to give historical context around something, especially in the podcast where, you know, people come to us for some of that is, well, how many people on earth could do that? And what's significant here is I think the answer is one. I think it's Jasmine Paris and that's it, at least right now. It would take years for it to be more than that. And the reason is that this race, one, it requires to be one of the best ultra runners in the world. Jasmine has won the spine race overall.
She actually excelled in like short distance ultra running too, like early on in her career.
She's a superstar.
She's wild talent.
She's one of the 10 best maybe ultra type multi-day athletes in the world. But then she backs that up with master navigation skills, which is a really unique ability to develop, almost orienteering style world championship level. And then the third is you need a multi-year focus on the specific details of this event, including the lore of the event. Mm-hmm. So Jasmine had to fail twice here to really deeply understand it and dedicate herself fully to this accomplishment. So to me, this is the moonshot. This is, you know, John F. Kennedy in 1960 saying, we're going to land a man on the moon. Similarly, like I think Jasmine's like, I'm going to finish this race. And she did it. And it's just so freaking cool and shocking. And I mean, I think it says a lot about her as one of the best endurance athletes who has ever lived.
And I'm curious too. And I do think Jasmine is like the one woman who can do this. Like this performance.
As of now. Maybe multi-year focus.
But that's actually my question is, I feel like if you asked Jasmine, she would say, I'm opening the floodgates for other women to do this. And I'm curious to see like how it is always interesting, like when one person crosses the barrier, oftentimes like statistically there is a flood of other people learning from that, being inspired from that, and even just recognizing that it is humanly possible. Like we've both wondered that for a long time, and we're the ultimate you know, we really root for people. And so I'm curious to see how this manifests in like the next following for women, and also people like, you know, you have to what's the famous quote? Like, see her to be her.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot harder in the case of Jasmine because she's like world-class, one of a kind. But I do think it creates this impetus for more women to come and to do this.
So that's a good question. Do you think this is the sub-4 mile where Roger Bannister breaks it and then tons of people break it within the next decade? And now, you know, sub-4 mile doesn't even get you to the NCAA championships. Do you think it's that? Or do you think it's something a little bit more historically unprecedented?
I think it's historically unprecedented because the 4-minute mile has very clear parameters.
Yeah.
Barkley does not. Yeah. And it's like the 4-minute mile at the like the...
It's the 4-minute mile if they decided after Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, hey, now we're going to put a massive dragon pit in the middle of the
track. It's like all of a sudden the mile becomes a steeplechase. And yeah. I feel like that's Laz's brain. So Laz is the one who puts the book pages in different areas on the course.
And watch the documentary, The Race That Eats Its Young, if you want a little bit of background on the lore here.
Yeah. And so I feel like it's up to his discretion. Yeah. And it's just going to be wild in the coming years, given that there were 5 finishers. But I do think it's going to open the doors for women that care, especially like the younger generation as well. And I'm really excited about
it's so cool. And I guess my big contrast here is let's look at 2 of Laz's races. We have Barkley's, which is this one that's really captured the imagination. It's wild on Twitter just how much traction this gets. Like international recognition. This was covered in the BBC. Basically every major news outlet was looking at this. And then the other is Big's Backyard, which is when people do 4.16 miles every hour for as long as they can. And I think Big's Backyard also captures the imagination. But for me, that gets back to the question, how many people on earth could do this? And this year, I had the reflection of like, well, if we put Zach Miller out there or one of these athletes that competes at the very top level and they care deeply about this event, I'm pretty sure they could go indefinitely. And maybe not, maybe I'm wrong on that, but I think the limits of that event have yet to be pushed. I think the answer here is that we're looking at the one woman that I know of right now who without, just that makes this possible. And so for me, it's like, wow, she proved me so damn wrong off of what I've said on this very podcast that I need to recognize my own shit that like, maybe the answer is just to set the bar really, really high and see what happens.
It's so cool. And I did this like full Jasmine deep dive on the internet. Yeah. I was watching like YouTubes from her from like 6 years ago. And she's a captivating person herself. So mom of 2, she's a PhD. She studies like cancer biology as it relates to like small animals as well as humans. And it was just, I thought I was really captivated by her training and the fact that she doesn't do like the training that she does for this is very attainable. Like she does like 60 to 90 minute runs during the week, like 3 to 4 hour long runs on the weekend and some steady running and racing in there. And that was actually the giveaway to me that I think that what she did is truly one of a kind because it's like, I think it's her brain and her athletic ability.
Yeah. And her history.
Like a lot of people train like that. And, you know, she is who she is off of what is a very reasonable type of training plan.
Yeah. I mean, it is just truly bonkers. Her entire life context reminds me of that old joke that like whenever you see female runners, it's like PhD has done 17 degrees, has 17 children, and then all that. And then it's like guy runner. And then it's just like, just a guy. It's just Ryan Gosling over there just like, yeah, I'm Ken. What she did is great. And I think the big message for me is to broaden our horizons about what's possible. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes as much as I dream big and believe in these impossible, scary things, I can sometimes get caught up in being like, well, is that even something worth chasing? Because it's so improbable. And I think that's still Barkley. Like, I'm not sure if Jasmine finishes, you know, 100 out of 100 times that we run this type of simulation.
Oh, for sure not. I mean, yeah. I would estimate like 30 out of 100 times.
And
which actually, yeah. And she's run this 3 times. So maybe that's almost exactly what we're seeing.
But then seeing the video in the photo of her coming into the finish where she gets to the gate and gets there just, 90 seconds before the 60 hour cutoff and then collapses. I'm like, you know, that proves to me that like what we think these constraints actually are is not even close to the edge because it takes someone pushing the edge beyond what is thinkable to show, you know, that those things that we think are unthinkable are just people haven't dared to spend years of their lives focused on these goals. So for my thing is spend years of our lives focused on those big, scary goals.
And the process itself is so cool. But if you haven't looked at the footage, like the finishing footage of the videos and the photos of her finishing, go do it. Because I actually think I cried more seeing those than just watching our gay country music.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I lost a lot of electrolytes watching that video. And also want to uplift all the men that finished, including John Kelly. There was a beautiful moment right before the final loop. So on the final loop, you have to go different directions than the person that went before you. And so very few people ever get on the final loop. So usually it's just one or two people doing this, sometimes zero. Like often people, no one makes it past loop three. In fact, a woman had never made it past loop three of five. And Jared Campbell waited for Jasmine Parrish. Jared Campbell, who had already finished this three times, he's a legend of the sport. He waited for her at the gate so that she could choose the direction that she wanted to go. And said, you go that direction. Because I think he knew on some level that it was going to take that dream last lap to make it happen. And I thought that was one of the beautiful moments too about how this is a community achievement. Like we should celebrate Jasmine as much as possible. And then also celebrate the infrastructure that makes this type of achievement possible, which is kind of everybody in the community believing that these impossible things can be possible, but we have to like really lift others up to make that happen.
And it is the coolest part of the ultra community. And I feel like when there's 40 runners at Barkley, it's almost like they're like a small family out there, like cheering each other on. And like, I think that like insular element of it, as much as like, I want more people to be able to run Barkley, I think is actually very cool. Okay. But I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay.
So I know you're not going to like this, but
I'm going to hate it. I can tell.
You coached John Kelly.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you've coached him now for a while and coached him to multiple Barkley finishes. And I think that's so cool. And you're always on Patreon, you're a little hesitant to talk about his training just because you're like, that's not the point. Like, I don't want to make this about me in the process. And it's not about you. But I am incredibly curious about how you structured his training just on like a broad level and what that means for like longer ultras and multi-day ultras.
Okay. I'll talk about it on a broad level. I don't like to get too much into individual details. We were talking about this on Patreon because I think after a while, if you do that, it's just kind of putting too much on the coaching and not enough on the athlete.
Yeah, I know, but it's interesting.
Okay.
Also, everyone knows, I mean, John Kelly is a beast. And like,
he's a beast before I came along too.
You could also just, you could probably be a random number generator to some extent for John Kelly. And like, you know, in this type of event, he would prevail. And so with that context in mind, I would just love to hear how you structure this training.
Sounds very similar to what Jasmine's doing.
Yeah.
Like we focus on speed year round. John Kelly's biggest, you know, advantage is that he's fast as hell. You know, he could probably run a sub 220 marathon if we really train for it for a year, and he's run under 230. So, we focus on that. And then in the last like 4 to 6 weeks, start emphasizing vert a little bit more, but it's not unattainable. I think some people have excelled at Barkley doing like 30 to 40,000 foot vert weeks and really pounding their bodies into submission.
Actually, there was a documentary on Gary Robbins who did a lot of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not what we do at all, because my thinking is like, look, we can't control Barkley. Like there are some years where it is impossible for anybody to finish Barkley. Like John Kelly has gotten two laps some years where the weather just doesn't cooperate and no one can do anything. In which case, like, let's not sacrifice the long-term speed development, the ability to just keep improving running economy for this race. Let's do what we need to do to be ready. But again, that becomes probably a little bit harder to do when an athlete isn't quite as talented and great as John is at all of the little things. Like he's just master at planning, master at navigation so fast. So basically it's like everything else in swap. It kind of looks the same exact way as your training for the 50K did, just with a few more miles.
Which is so cool. And I think that's the part that I really like. And actually Jasmine's training is very similar. And interestingly, I don't know if she's still coached by Damian Hall, but at one point in time, she was coached by Damian Hall.
Who's the best,
who you coach. So I was like, maybe there's like a little bit of like trickle down of swap training theory.
Yeah. Well, actually, let's do, as a transition to Crown King Scramble, a little bit of a reflection on kind of what that question brought up for me, which is, you mentioned Ann Trason ran the 50K that we did, and Ann's the best athlete that's ever lived.
Ann is an all-time legend.
Yeah, she's a good.
How many Western States has she run? Ooh, I should know
she
that.
She won 11 of them, maybe more even. I think—
In historically fast times.
Yeah, and at every course. I think she has the Leadville course record still. She's just a monster in every sense. And who knows, maybe she was just out there training. But I think—
Well, actually, I was going to say, when you look at my time and when you look at Ann Trason's time, I was like, did she turn around and run the course as 100K? Like, you just never know the context of a training day. And you look at the scoreboard and it's like, Ann Trason, 111. Megan, like 0.5 or 1. Yeah.
Who has had more smart food popcorn, though?
Oh, that's fair. I mean, we don't know though.
I'm sure. Yeah. It's impossible to beat you. You are the goat. You're like of smart food popcorn.
Statistically, Megan, you are in the 99th percentile.
It just depends how you're scoring, right? Like race wins, not the only way to score. Find the thing that you're great at and go for that thing. But what it points out to me is that this race that we did, the 50K, the Conquering Scramble, has been around for 32 years. It's been a staple of a bunch of the best athletes of previous generations have done it. And I think one of the weird things about ultra training and training in general is I'll often be coaching athletes or be reading about training theory and hear, okay, this is what this person did in the 1990s or 2000s to great success. And I think it's such a weird way to frame it because let's think about another sport. Let's think about football or something. Like, no, everyone's always has this argument, like how would Jim Brown stack up in football today? Or how would Babe Ruth stack up in baseball today? And the arguments are always like, would they strike out all the time or would they make do with the modern era and do really great? But the difference is no one argues we should train like Jim Brown and Babe Ruth. And so athletes now are going so much faster on most of the same courses, though Andreessen breaks that model at races like Leadville. So there are exceptions for sure.
And Western States as well. We've actually done some modeling at Western States. Yeah. And when you control for things, it's like the basic premise of the models is
but only Andreessen relative, is insane. Relative to her cohort.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And my point being that the in running, sometimes we're like, well, how about those incredible athletes in the past? Not like Anne, but more like the, let's say the 10th ranked athlete. And now athletes are going so many hours faster. And my point is like, yes, we uplift those athletes. If they were around now, they'd also be excelling at the same level as the very top people. Now they'd be faster. But the reason everybody is faster is modern training methods and everything. So, you know, as we reflect on the history of running training, make sure we also bring in the modern training methods and don't apply like the old school training of just running a crap ton of miles. Because I think as we're seeing at Barkley, that's not the way it works.
Yeah, I hear that sometimes Andreessen would go out for like 8-9 hour long runs just like on the Western States course, like for the hell of it. And I feel like that our training theory has shifted away to like maybe you get those types of long runs in races.
Yeah.
But I feel like very few athletes are doing those in isolation. But I would love to apply modern training theory as well as modern fueling theory to our like legends in the sport and then see what happens. Because I mean, I'm curious, like I don't know the answer. Like, do you think Andreessen was feeling with 90 grams of carbs per hour?
I doubt it.
Yes.
Just because I don't think anybody was.
Yeah.
And that's a great transition into Crown King Scramble. We'll have a few more thoughts on Jasmine later. The big overarching theme is we just saw one of the biggest things ever. Make sure that you take this in of what Jasmine just did, because we're probably never going to see anything like that again. And I'm sure that one of Jasmine's biggest skills was fueling. And similarly, like that's been just this huge thing in the progress of the sport and something Megan and I both focused on. So Megan ran 4:30. It was the second fastest time ever, behind only Ida Nielsen, who's also, you know, has absolutely rocked the world history of ultras. For men, I was second place, but ran under the previous course record by a pretty substantial margin as well. And significantly, the guy that beat me, Ryan Raff, put in his Strava that he fueled with 100 grams of carbs per hour as well. So I was like, fuck, no wonder he beat me. At the end, I thought my advantage was going to be crushing him on the final climb. And he ran away from me like I was standing still when I was still running well. And I'm like, The fueling, it's just the fueling does it.
The fueling does it. And I actually think Ryan, he mentioned that he listens to our podcast. And I actually did the math and I was like, I wonder if our podcast is making it harder sometimes to compete. It's such a win because it's like, you know, iron sharpens iron. The faster, I mean, Ryan probably pulled you to a faster time.
And I mean, yes, I think we both pulled each other to a faster time. Because I went out a little faster. Yeah, it is kind of a bad reflection. So you're above my level, right? So you don't have to worry about this much. But I was thinking after he told me he listens, he's the nicest guy. Ryan Raff, he's going to be an absolute international superstar of the sport. I'll get into some details on him soon. But as he said, he listened to the podcast. I was like, because people listen to the podcast, I'm never going to win a race again. Yeah. I'm just going to run under course records and get ass beat because people understand to fuel and do uphill treadmills and get fast. It's like, no, if you're my competitors, please don't listen. You can just like not. So actually, if you're wanting to do the fueling game, the place to go is to thefeed.com/swap, S-W-A-P. This is our page on the feed where you get $80 in free credit. Just It is the best for buying fuel. We both used a range of fuels, including Science and Sport Beta Fuel Gels. Each of these have 40 grams of carbs and they're liquid, so it's wonderful. Also used Precision Gels throughout the day. It was just such a good option.
Well, I think the big advantage of the feed is being able to try different types of gels. And I do feel like when you're out there, especially for longer races, it's nice to have different arrows in your quiver in terms of like, I'm craving this or I'm craving that. My interesting reflection actually is, so on course, there was no crew. It was kind of a logistically complicated one-way course.
Point to point, mostly uphill. 7,000 feet of climbing, a few thousand feet of descending.
So there were no crew access. And so I was grabbing goo roctanes off the table, which I haven't taken in years. Yeah. Like I'm at this point very much like a liquid gel connoisseur. I really like that liquid gel taste. And my hot take actually is that my body feels amazing on goo roctanes if I can take them down. Okay. So they're thick as shit, like thick and nasty kind of is how I would describe goo roctanes after not having them for 5 years. But there's something about, they have amino acids in them. They have caffeine. And for whatever reason, no. I feel like it's my rocket fuel.
Nope. I refuse to let you do this with our podcast platform. Yeah. I tried to take one of these goo roctanes and I was able to stuff it down, but it wanted to come up so bad. Why is it so thick?
It is so thick. And I don't think I realized, like back in the day, I was like, this is the elixir of the gods. Yeah. This is good stuff. But then I had, you know, like liquid-based gels. And all of a sudden I'm like, why is this stuff so nasty? It's so sticky.
Could you imagine doing 90 grams of carbs per hour just from roctane gels?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I could actually because I am
partial
to them.
How? You have to always be fueling. I mean, they are not that high calorie. And they have like the consistency of trying to swallow beef jerky.
Yeah, it is like that. But you know what? Sometimes time passes really slow in a race. So I don't typically have classic Megan fashion. I don't have a pacing schedule. I don't have a fueling schedule.
No.
I just go out and I approximate. So at one point I looked down at my watch and I had fueled at like 3:20. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, like, you know, a little bit later, I was like, oh, it's probably time to fuel again. And I looked down at my watch and it's 3:27. And I was like, Jesus, time fast is really slow in an ultra marathon sometimes.
Yeah. So for everybody out there, like get these gels down. The reason that you can do this high calorie fueling is because of liquid calories from your bottle. That's the first thing. And then liquid calories from these gels or hydrogel solutions. So Precision is a hydrogel. Science and Sport is more of a liquid gel. So it goes down. I can do 40 grams of carbs in one squirt from these gels.
Yeah,
it's insane.
Goo, please make a hydrogel. Make the same goo roctane formulation in a hydrogel.
Just a little bit bigger gel, honestly. Make a little bit more liquid. We love goo, the company. We love what goo does. But for me, it is vomit fuel at the end of a race. I don't know how people do it.
Well, I feel like actually the challenge is goo is the leader. Like of fueling and of like the fueling revolution before 90 grams of carbs became this like staple in sport.
Well, on their packaging, it says have a gel at 15 minutes and every 45 minutes after.
Which is like vastly underfueling.
So underfueling.
But I feel like they will, if they can catch up and get a hydrogel suspension, I think it's going to help a ton. But I do think it's really helpful to try all of these products, to try different flavors, because you never know. Like in a race, I grabbed chocolate sea salt goo at one point and I was just like, oh, fuck me. But you know what? I ate it and it's good to have practice with different types of fuel.
Sounds like my Nesquik.
Yeah. Actually, every trip that we do to race, you buy an entire thing of Nesquik and eat like a quarter of it and leave it in an Airbnb.
So this is important. This is about fueling. is when we go to the grocery store, I'm like, I rely on my morning Nesquik. I have it in my tea with some salt. So it is very chocolate sea salty. And then I'm like, what better donation to give to the Airbnb than a half, like, well, honestly, like a barely consumed thing of Nesquik?
Well, they don't sell single serving things of Nesquik. They need performance.
The feed.
Yes.
The feed. Get on it. Sell me some single serving Nesquik. All right. Let's break down some thoughts just individually from Crown King Scramble, which was this awesome race. I think we both had really good days out there. And it's exciting because I think sometimes when we do the podcast and we go through all this stuff, I sometimes can downplay my own athletics. And so to go out and, I mean, I really, you know, took the reins of that race. And I think the reason we all, like, the times were fast for men, 5 of the 10 fastest times ever, both Ryan and I went under the course record. Ryan beat me by a few minutes, mostly at the end, is because, like, I decided we're going for the course record at mile 2. I was just like, all right, let's go for it. This is time.
Which, quite frankly, is pretty ballsy coming off the training that you had done. So you had a knee boop. It wasn't that long ago that we were talking about like the gonads within your knee in reference to like some of the ACL findings you had and just like the fact that you had a little bit of a traumatic knee injury. And so you've been biking and cross training a ton.
An uphill treadmill,
which obviously helps. It's an uphill race, which but there was like 3,000 feet
downhill.
And
it was slow uphill running that I was doing on the treadmill. So I think part of it is because I've had this heart rate data. So I can see in my heart rate data, I'm like, I don't know what happened to my fitness, why my fitness is so good after this, but I'm going to roll with it and go race this aggressively. And worked out. But what led you to race pretty aggressively, especially because like you said, you race above your training sometimes, and I have faith in you, but where did it come from yourself? Like, where did the faith in yourself come from?
Quite honestly, I didn't know I was racing aggressively. And this is the perk of, for me, of like what I feel like I call soul running is I truly run best when I go out there and I just run my own race.
Yeah.
When I don't have like preconceived notions of splits or times or even just like logistics for whatever reason, like this is how, and it's strange, especially as a coach, because I dive into this for athletes. Yeah. Like it really truly does help some athletes, but it doesn't help me. And I think if I had splits at like 8 miles and 16 miles and 20 miles in terms of like historical times, I've been like, Megan, slow your ass down. But I didn't have those splits, so I didn't know.
What is this going to do with the next race? I feel like, because you had such a successful day, Megan, it's just going to get worse. I'm going to be trying to tell you the barest bones details about the race. And you're going to be like, nope, I'm just showing up. I don't even care how far it is.
Well, in the mornings, I always look at Strava before we race.
Yeah.
So like I had a little bit of context.
By look at Strava, you mean literally glance. I might have gotten you to look at that for 7 seconds.
Yeah. But you know, that's, and I think there is something in the fact of like being out there and sometimes having expectations.
Yeah.
Like those are expectations that sometimes can be constraints. And so I think there is a delicate balance. Like everyone, there's a spectrum of like soul running to which I'm on the very left, to full spreadsheets of planning and existence, which I would have to do if I ran Barkley and I would have to do if I ran more complicated races. But I do think like understanding where you are on that and just making sure you're not placing constraints on yourself that might actually be expectations.
I love that. And so I had a couple interesting thoughts on your race. The first is you actually used heart rate a little bit to pace, right? How'd that work out for you?
Yeah, that was not my plan. I actually don't usually do that, but I love the Coros armband monitor.
They've been so wonderful for
us. It's been incredible. I was skeptical. I was like, I really like my heart rate monitor, like my chest strap. I can like stick it to my sports bra. I safety pin it there. But then once I started wearing the armband monitor, I was like, I'm never going back.
So how did you use it?
So I wasn't planning to use it. So typically I don't look at heart rate during a race, but I was well in the lead at mile 8 and I knew this. And I had a moment where I was like, Megan, like, don't do something stupid out here. Okay, like I wanted to make sure that my heart rate wasn't spiking up to like 175 or something like this. But so I turned on my heart rate data and I was like, Megan, I just want to make sure you are being somewhat smart. And it turns out my heart rate was actually lower than I thought it was.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a useful metric of like, oh, I have room to push a little bit more. And I didn't have that expectation that that's how I would race.
Yeah. Well, it's great to get the data in training because then you can use it in different ways.
Yeah.
And you can learn like how to approach it because you, I think, basically learned you can push upper end Z3 in 4.5 hour 50Ks that are net uphill.
Actually, the Strava breakdown, which I think is, my Strava is like pretty decent heart rate zones for myself. It told me I was 98.5% of the race in Z3.
Yeah.
Which is, and I think one helpful thing that I was finding too is that like, I roll the downhills pretty fast and my heart rate stays up during that time. And I think it is one advantage. Like if you look at my heart rate on the file, it's basically just like a straight line.
You should push the downhills a little bit.
Pushing the downhills a little bit. Yeah. And following it gave me the confidence to also push the uphills a little bit more than I classically would. And it was just really interesting to kind of see it throughout the race.
And that's the big benefit of fueling is if you fuel with these really high carb totals, you're able to push harder.
Yes.
Because if an athlete was fueling more traditionally, like 45 grams of carbs per hour, a gel every, you know, a small gel every half hour or something, they'd have to be like under Z2.
Yeah, you lose the substrate to be able to.
Yeah, you bonk.
To bonk.
If you push that hard, because you burn so much glycogen when you're pushing hard.
And there is some natural heart rate decline. So even I was doing what I estimate to be 90 grams of carbs per hour, but you know, I wasn't following the exact.
No.
I was just slurping at all times, taking in random stuff.
You're so funny. You're the smartest person that's ever lived. You coach in such a detailed oriented way. You just are on top of it so much. And in races, you're like, I'm just always going to be taking a gel and constantly finishing a bottle and then running kind of hard.
I call it party raging. Yeah. Sometimes you just got to go out there and rage, and it's very different than how I coach.
Yeah.
But I estimate that I was taking like 90 grams of carbs per hour, give and take. But my heart rate, I even had some like heart rate decline at the end of the race. And it is very natural to kind of have like elevations in the beginning and then to kind of like settle in the middle miles.
Okay. So let's have a couple of reflections about the race itself. The first I want to ask you about is you decided not to take baby Leo across the finish line, Megan. What was the calculus there?
Do you want to know the honest answer?
Uh-huh.
There wasn't even any calculus.
No.
I didn't
make it into the spreadsheet.
I didn't even consider it.
Okay.
All of a sudden I was like, okay, so I didn't know what the course record was.
Yeah.
Because of course I didn't look. and I had some context that Ann Tracen ran 4:34. So when I was coming in at 4:30, I was like, maybe this is the course record. I don't know.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I'm just going to sprint to the finish. But there was a part in my brain that never even processed grabbing Leo and bringing him to the finish. And then after, I was like, oh, damn, maybe it would have been fun to share that memory with Leo and like have that magic of crossing the finish line together. And then my brain came back to the point and I was like, nope, it was for me.
Yeah.
I mean, it was truly like this performance, it actually meant like a ton to me. Like definitely to be able to do that and to feel like I'm back after having so many struggles. Like I never thought I was going to get here. And Leo was with me on the podium. He gave me a root beer, which he put like rocks into.
Yeah.
So we had like really special magical moments. I didn't need to haul him a quarter mile to the finish.
I love that. Just leave him on the side there. But then you take him up to the podium when your award was a 4-foot long pickaxe, like an actual pickaxe that's totally usable. And you're just like, I'm going to carry Leo and this pickaxe at the same time.
And I could barely get up to the step on the podium because my legs were so wobbly. Then I was holding a baby. But fortunately, in like classic women helping women moment, Lindsay Allison, who was second, and Abby Toomey, who was third, helped me with the axe as I was holding Leo. So it was great.
Sometimes you got to carry a baby and an axe at the same time for the gram. Yeah. That's how you get those likes on Instagram.
Did you consider crossing the finish line with Leo?
No. I mean, I only want to do that like when I'm just kind of joyriding out there. That being said, I'm a different level athlete than you. I'm good, but I'm not on that trajectory you're on.
I don't know about that. Granted, you just ran a very good time off of functionally cross training.
Yeah. So a couple reflections from me on this. First is I did step up strength work a little bit while I was injured, and squats in particular became a part of what I did. I do 2x10 reps of 135 pounds, which is so hilarious considering when I was in high school, I was a big fire hydrant shaped boy who would squat 300 plus pounds and just rep it out. And now 135 makes my intestines come out of my eyeballs. But I do think that it played a little bit of a role. I had no issues with cramping. So, swap strength work's definitely going to add that element. And I thought that plus the uphill treadmill at the high end of Z2 both made me pretty confident. I think my aerobic system and my muscular system were just kind of on a different level. Like I really felt like I leveled up in some way in this build. And I don't know why. It's kind of the wild part of training theory is that it's operating on such a long time scale, but then also these short interventions that it's a little bit distracting to know which is which sometimes.
And I feel like the uphill treadmill is like something that I often cue into and lock into on steep race courses. And it's so nice just to be like, to some extent, even like the mountain is doing the work for me. The way this course was structured is the first like 12 miles were pretty fast. They were on like rolling dirt roads, and then it pitched up into steep, like rocky type of like four-wheel drive type of roads.
Yeah.
And it was really nice. There was like something very like, I don't know, heartwarming in the sense of I could just let the mountain do the work for me.
Yeah.
And it felt biomechanically a little bit slower, but I almost have that like same feeling on the treadmill. And I think if you can lock into that on the treadmill, it helps a ton in races with climbing.
I tried to let the mountain do the work for me. And then this guy, Ryan Rapp, just like, no, I'm going to work the mountain. Quick reflection on him is the last time I had this experience where I was racing in a way that I thought was to the peak level of my abilities in that moment. And I knew I was going under this historic course record, and the course record's held by a 209 marathoner. So like legit stuff. And I was going to go way under it. The last time I had this feeling of getting dusted in that context was in 2016, when I went to Montana for a little 30K and a guy just absolutely blew my doors off. And that was a young Jim Walmsley. Similarly, Ryan Rath is 24. He's incredibly fast. He ran at NAU. I think he's going to be a superstar of the sport. And it was very fun to get to see that in person, because I think this was maybe the first race where he kind of had the Neo in the Matrix moment where he realized if he paces well, because he actually went out much easier than me even. He was like 40 seconds behind at one point. Fuel that well, like what's going to be possible for him. So, and he's a great guy. So I can't wait to see what he does next.
How was that context when he passed you? So I think there's always something about like knowing what you're doing personally. So like for me, I was like looking at my heart rate and I was knowing the times I was running. And I was like, if someone wants to come from behind and catch me, that's incredible. They're throwing down. And it's really nice sometimes just to be at mile 24 and to be like, I'm having a day for me.
Yeah.
And this is great. How does it feel like when someone, and I've this has happened to me before, when you're having a day like that, like you're having a historic day and someone comes and catches and passes you, like what's the narrative that's going on in your head in that process?
Well, we ran together for a really long time. And I thought the whole time, I was like, he's going to come back for sure. Because like an athlete that's able to do this would be like world champion level. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I just caught it when he was figuring it out rather than him being there. I was just so happy for him. Like, actually, there's a video of me crossing the finish line from Aravaipa where you can see my emotions about it. It's like, wow, you earned this. You are amazing. I cannot wait to see what you do next. And kind of gets back to the rooting for others element that for me, I'm like, man, I just got to witness a little bit of history, I think. Like, I think this is going to be one of those guys that in 6 years we're talking about in the very top echelon of the history of the sport. And if what I just saw was what I think it is as a coach, then I'm just kind of honored mm-hmm. to be there and to be a small part of it. But even if it wasn't, like, if I was just struggling and it would have just been like, wow, you know, racing is such a cool element to put yourself out there, get vulnerable, and then everybody goes and shares pulled pork at the finish line.
Is there was so like as you were out there, were you looking at your heart rate to understand that? Because like yeah. I know for me sometimes I very rarely look at heart rate in races. But like for me during this race, like I knew there was nowhere up I could go. Like yeah. I was putting out an effort and like if someone came and caught me, amazing. Like there's yeah. nothing I could have done about that physiologically. Were you looking at your heart rate and was that like a constraint or was that something that was like heartwarming to you?
So I looked at it for the first 2 miles.
Yeah.
And then never looked at it again. Because my thinking was I realized when I saw that the course was quick early on that that course record was totally doable, this like mm-hmm. historic course record.
Yeah.
But the only way it was going to happen is if I took the reins of the race a little bit and started to push slightly. And I was like, I don't even want to know. Because I also think the way for me to race my best is like, I do have a pretty high threshold for climbing. That's why we recommend all this stuff about uphill training and treadmill and speed and all that. So my best bet at the time I was racing with Mekhi Clemens, who ended up third, ran a great race. He's a superstar. I think I can push Mekhi above his threshold on every single uphill. So I'm not going to look at my own heart rate because I know that feeling and I'm just not going to, I'll push below that, but to the low end Z4 rather than staying in Z3. So for me, it's like, I just don't even want to know now. It's race time. From here to the finish line, we are racing history. We are, you know, racing each other is a secondary consideration. And I think it paid off in terms of, you know, Mekhi was third and it worked for him, but I think I ran into someone that had a better climbing threshold than I did. And basically it was a fitness race and Ryan's fitness was better. And so, you know, I wanted to make it a fitness race and not a strategy race.
That's beautiful. And I do think like sometimes uphill courses are true. Like every race going into it is a celebration. And yeah. I think we fully had that mindset. Like we recorded a Patreon at 5 p.m. the night before doing this race. And it was like our mindset heading in is it is a true celebration.
Yeah.
But I do think to some extent, net uphill races are kind of a fitness test mm-hmm. in an interesting way. And like, that's not how I would phrase it to an athlete. But I think in retrospect, when you look back on data, it's like, it can be a really helpful fitness evaluator.
Yeah. And I think it gets back to what you said about chucking that 50K last week, where, you know, I think as coaches, our goal is to optimize an individual's fitness, not just in the winning sense, but wherever your individual fitness is, like your running economy, your ability to run fast, because that's basically all we control. Everything else is you learn over time and maybe a spreadsheet helps a little, but I think Megan shows maybe it doesn't either.
So, okay. Are you going to fight me on that again?
I'm always going to fight you on that.
Are you going to make me have a spreadsheet for the next race?
For Canyon's 100K, are you not going to look at where the aid stations are and get to learn those in detail?
Well, I will look at aid stations. That's important for like okay. health and fueling and context, but I'm not going to have splits to those aid stations.
So you're just going
to
trust me for the like what to give you at different times?
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, no. I will know. I mean, at the race, literally, I just was grabbing like 8 Roctanes and shoving them into my sports bra.
Are you planning to do that with NAC at Canyon's?
No, not with NAC. Okay. You'll have like science and sport and precision and maybe some goo Roctanes in there. So
yeah.
We'll roll with it.
So what are you thinking about Canyon's 100K now that we're a few days post-race? How are you feeling? What are your thoughts?
I feel great. Actually, my body feels, you know, it is nerve-wracking to go into a race like this. It's my first ultra.
Yeah.
In maybe 5 years, I was doing the math. I was like, when was the last time I ran an ultra? My hot take is that I wish that Canyons were also uphill because the uphill race format was really fun. Yeah. No, I'm excited. I think like I believe in myself again in a way that I just haven't before in years because of health context. And I'm really excited to be able to live in this new space of like gratitude to be able to do it at all and self-belief. And I want to make sure that I hold two of those in tandem and don't let the fact that I now have this newfound confidence take hold of how I think about running or like the context of my life.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Just to keep the perspective.
Keep the perspective. Yeah. And I'm like so lucky to have this perspective. And now that I'm back to a place that I truly feel like myself, like running, I understand the running, the context of running and racing within my life. And it's about so much more than performance. It's about, you know, stories and getting to do this at all and adventures and structuring the daily process. And I just don't want to forget that.
So I have two memories I'm going to take away from this race and they're seared into my brain. Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
The first is coming around the corner right after you finish, like it finishes at a saloon. And seeing you on the ground.
I went full ultra to ground quite fast.
Yeah, very similar to what Jasmine did actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Very cool. But also seeing that look on your face, which I think was just like almost in awe of what just happened. And you look so satisfied. And for me, it's just like, wow, reflecting on, you know, the picture that we also have of you in the hospital in your hospital gown eating chicken tenders, you know, it's like kind of like the same look almost of just being like, I'm here, I did it. Like whatever I'm doing, I'm doing. And I'll always remember that moment.
It was my, I mean, I actually had a premature moment. It was like premature happening at mile 26. And I was like, girl, you better finish. You better get to that finish. Like,
no, you better not finish. Finish too soon.
Yes.
But then the second reflection, and you might kill me for saying this, is the smell when I walked into the bathroom on race morning. So at 4 a.m., I don't know what you did in there, Megan, but it was devilish. And I think it might have been our pre-race burgers we had the night before.
We had massive pre-race burgers the night before. But don't give me shit because it worked.
It did.
You pooped out there on the course.
I did.
I pooped once in the day.
Maybe I lost because I had to poop.
I know. Exactly. So you know what? Sometimes you have it. Sometimes you got to have like a big poop. You got to do it well and then not do it again.
Yeah. Well, also final takeaway is that pre-race burgers, I think, are the best meal. Often I focused on carbs and all this. I think the big thing is give your body a satisfaction bomb. So we had burgers and this massive plate of tater tots. It was insane.
It was an insane quantity of food. Actually, there's a picture on my Instagram of us eating these burgers. And we probably ate 3/4 of the plate, which is, to me, a big achievement.
Yeah.
But it was really nice because sometimes, like, for me, it was nice to stand on the start line and be like, I am fully glycogen loaded and I have confidence.
Unless even – I think glycogen's part of it, but I think a lot of it's just your body does that and it kind of just knows, for me at least, it's like, I'm safe. I'm ready to go venture into the great beyond in this event because – you're just fully, you know, like you're not resource depleted at all. Like, I think there's almost something evolutionary to that type of meal that it's even different than something like pasta or whatever. It's like, I have a burger at these races or the vegetarian equivalent, whatever that is for you, that has everything, protein, fat, carbs, just to the max, fried food, whatever it is. And just, I'm like, fuck, I am ready to venture into the wilderness.
And it's so fun to just be ready for an adventure. And that's kind of a takeaway I had too, is I feel like I am in a slightly different context of life where like we're living a lot of life right now. Like I'm learning how to train as a parent, working multiple jobs. And like, it's been a little different in how that looks. And for the first time in my life, I was really excited to taper.
Yeah.
I was like, I just want to have a day where I freaking have 30 minutes to read a book on the couch. Yeah. And
well, you did have the crying event on the couch the week before.
I know.
A lot of listeners were inspired by that, by the way.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah. This is my full evolution as a runner.
They've seen it all.
But the nice part about the taper is come Saturday, like I felt like I got that out of my system. I was like, I sat on the couch, I read a book, and I just was so excited to go adventure. And I think whatever you're doing in the taper or in the fueling period, get yourself to the point that come race day, you're like, I just need to run.
Yeah.
And I think if you're not experiencing that on race day, either like have a more aggressive taper or like have more food or do a combination of both.
Or change the way you taper.
Yes.
Like what you did before the race is the day before, your heart rate got a little bit higher at times. You did like a 5.5 miler on trails. And for you, we've learned kind of like you're already recovered going into that day before the race. The day before the race, you can push it a little bit more on hills. Nothing hard, but you did get some trophies, some second place trophies on Strava. And like that works for you really well. And we saw that too, like with Matt Daniels before the check-in at 50K, I had him do 5x1 minute hills the day before because he doesn't excel off of a very, very easy day. So get creative with your taper.
Well, it's also fun too. So we went to like Sunrise Mountain in Phoenix, Arizona, which is like this beautiful place to go run.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those magical moments where I didn't want the run to end. And it's such a good way to go into a race where on Friday you're like, oh, we have to like stop this run.
Yeah.
And then to go race on Saturday was really cool. But I did get inspiration because we were running by, like everyone was so nice in Arizona. And I told a runner as we were running by, I was like, oh, you're amazing. Have a good day. Yeah. And they said something
like, you too.
You too. And then like 3 seconds later, as we're passing, I hear her say, speedy bitch. And I was like, okay, I'm definitely ready for this race. Yeah.
So thank you, hiker. I think you were trying to be mean under your breath. We heard you and it gave Megan confidence. Okay, let's end this with a listener message, actually, that's on running in general. I think we'll skip the uphills and downhills thing. So this is from Patreon and this is about their experience. I was alone on the side of a mountain in the middle of the night, 65 miles deep into my first attempt at 100 miles. I was moving forward as best as I could, forcing tiny bites of the quesadilla the aid station volunteer had shoved into my hand a half hour earlier. To drown out the negative voices that were starting to gather, I put my giant running playlist on shuffle. A song I had forgotten I had was up first. A cappella women's voices and drums in the following chorus. I am my mother's savage daughter, the one who runs barefoot, cursing sharp stones. I am my mother's savage daughter. I'll not cut my hair. I will not lower my voice. I sang that shit to the moon for the next 3 magical minutes, and it completely transformed my experience. I came home with that as my high point of the day, but I couldn't put my finger on why until I had a conversation with my neighbor, Greg. Greg used to run sled dogs in the Arctic, and when I shared this with him, he started talking about how magical it is to run dogs at night. They do this when it's too warm for the dogs to run during the day. Huskies run happier when cooler, and the firm snow makes the footing easier for them. And it's a magical experience for the musher. Quote, because eventually, when running overnight, you begin to see that something in that dog remembers that it was once a wolf.
It was once a wolf. Isn't it the best feeling when you're out there doing an ultra and sometimes even like running at night or running in the dark to help you get there, yeah, where you're like, I am wolf.
I am wolf.
I am wolf. And it's like, that is the part. I mean, it's irrespective of like where you finished or how the race goes. If you have some miles of a race that feel, yeah, like that, that to me is a win on the day. And I think that's like the coolest part of ultra running.
And when I walked into the bathroom on race morning, I was like, she's a wolf with a GI problem. Yeah. She's a wolf up with an issue.
Actually, as soon as I dropped that deuce, I was like, it's going to be a good day. It's gonna be a good day. My body is fueled. It is ready to go. Also, like when it happens all at once, yeah, you're like, this is adrenaline. This is nice.
It's so good. Okay. Okay. So join our Patreon. We answer tons of questions there. Bonus podcasts. We're up to 94 of these bonus podcasts where we give our thoughts, answer tons of questions. And last week, the Free Trail Fantasy winner said it was only because of our predictions. They posted that out. So Patreon.com/swap, SWAP. We have so much fun with it. And then one more fun takeaway. We asked a few weeks ago, where do people hear about the podcast? Like, because the numbers have increased a ton. And the answers we got back almost uniformly were word of mouth. So people telling their friends about it rather than some algorithm issue or something like that. So if you like the podcast, tell one friend. That's all we're asking. It seems like that's the way to do it. And you'll probably know if your friend is into this type of shit. Yeah. So tell that type of friend.
Or if you're an introvert like us, you can shout it to the moon.
Yes.
Much like our listener message that we just read, which sometimes is how I feel like I have to roll.
So perfect.
Be a wolf.
Okay. Do you want to get to news and fun things? I feel like we should skip the training. We talked enough about training there.
Well, I think the context of the training that we're going to talk about is, we'll just do it very, very briefly.
And we're already at 55 minutes, Megan.
This will be 2 minutes.
Okay.
Downhills are an opportunity.
Yes.
And I think for me, I was passing a lot of people, like a lot of men in this race on downhills.
Yeah.
And it was kind of confusing to me because for an uphill race. And I don't know. Also, historically, I feel like sometimes men are like, I don't know if this is like gender bias, but sometimes I feel like men kamikaze downhills more than women.
Yeah.
And so for me to be passing men on downhills was surprising. But I do think like using downhills as an opportunity in races is huge. And I think sometimes heart rate files or like how you run a race or even how you ran the race, David, is instructive of that.
Okay. Well, this is a wonderful tee up for Patreon, actually, because the big post the other week was on these types of details on downhill running. So even though this was an uphill race, the amount of time I made up on the course record on downhills was huge, even though I haven't run downhill much in training. And it gets back to some of the demands, the offset between biomechanical and aerobic system demands. So I'm going to drop some stats from my own running from the past few weeks that I think are instructive to listeners. The first is I did an 18 miler the week before the race at 6:16 pace at 144 heart rate. So 144 to push up to like, you know, for the race I just did, I averaged 160 the whole time. So to push up to 160 heart rate in training, I'd need to be running way too fast. You can't do that very often, right? That's a workout to do that ever. Meanwhile, on a downhill in training at 520 pace, my heart rate was 128. And then on the uphill treadmill at 20% grade, my heart rate gets to 150 even at 4 miles an hour. So the point of those numbers is just that when you're running downhill, those numbers of your heart rate are so offset from how hard you could push if you went farther. And so the idea is bring it closer together. Start to learn to run downhills faster. Every single downhill you see in training when it's part of the goal, just start flowing faster, 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 because it is going to be a huge opportunity, especially in races. Like there's no reason to let your heart rate drop excessively low on every downhill.
And I think when it's like part of the training, as you just mentioned, is really key though, because there are like pretty significant injury risk factors of doing this quite often. So I think this Saturday long run or whatever day your long run is a great time to practice like more efficient downhills.
Yeah.
And then maybe like within the context of a workout or once more during the week, but definitely not in every time you hit a downhill sort of situation.
But every long run.
Yes.
I think basically like the bigger thing I'm coming down to, I'm starting to put in athletes' logs on so much strong downs, because it's the time when, you know, your heart rate's going to be lower. And if you can start to push it higher, you're going to get those mechanical limitations to align a little bit more with aerobic ones. And then your race times are going to get so much faster. I think this is maybe even most important for athletes chasing cutoffs at the back of the pack. It's mm-hmm. like the downhills are your chance to make hay, to get ahead of your schedules. And, but it's a skill that you have to develop, because if you're just doing it on race day, it's going to fuck you up.
I love what you just said about make hay. And it brings me back to last week on the bike. So Monday before the race, I did a bike and I saw a sign. There's like so many signs for hay out here. We live kind of in the country on like gravel roads. And it was just said HA instead of the full hay. And I was like, I feel like that's how my hay is in the barn. It's like two thirds of the way in the barn. But it is an interesting reflection, is that like the hay doesn't always have to feel fully in the barn for you then to go on and have a race performance that surprises you.
I barely trained.
And so I think my context as a coach is put as much hay in the barn as is healthy and humanly possible. Like for me as an athlete, I've had to like flex a ton as a parent. Like my training has just looked totally different. And then have trust and party rage. But you don't always need like that those beautiful massive fucking stacks of hay in the barn.
And if you build your speed and just get kind of flexible with it, incredible things are possible. A lot of this stuff is nonlinear, and it's maybe the coolest part of training theory. That's why like we always try to emphasize principles of getting fast, you know, keeping your aerobic system strong, and then staying healthy. Like you do that and eat enough, sky's the freaking limit.
Burgers. And smart food popcorn. Actually, as the precursor to smelly poop.
You talk about that sign. It reminds me, somewhere on the course, you didn't see this, but there was a scarecrow type thing guarding an entrance to a ranch. And it said redneck with a riffle.
Oh, so I saw that actually.
Oh, instead of rifle, it had an extra F in there. And it looked quite scary. So I'm pretty glad we got through that race without them, you know, like knowing our full range of political beliefs. I feel like it might not have ended well.
There were some donkeys and burros out there too that were quite loud as well. Did you really, I mean, I don't really like process that. Like I saw all of those things during a race, but it's almost interesting, like the type of race brain where like it goes in one ear and then just kind of like fizzles out and doesn't come out the other.
I'm very much thinking the whole time. I don't have that ability that you do to tune things down, right?
Yeah.
Like there's this great movie, I think it's a pretty bad movie, but there's a movie I remember very closely. It's called For the Love of the Game. It was a Kevin Costner movie about baseball. And whenever he's pitching, so he's a pitcher in the majors, his brain just goes quiet and it tunes everything out. And it's called clearing the mechanism. I feel like you clear the mechanism when you get to races.
I do. And then every once in a while, something comes in and it's very salient thought. Yeah. Like at mile 20, whatever, when I was like, oh my gosh, Megan, like this is happening. And I was like, oh my, I need to like get back to clearing the brain.
I wish I had that ability. How do I do that?
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe just practice it. Like let it go. Like when you have a thought, just like let it go. And that's what I do too, is because sometimes I truly race best in that place where I'm not thinking about anything. And sometimes thoughts do come in and I have to let them go.
So the reference to clearing the mechanism reminds me of like a semi-traumatic high school moment. I think I mentioned this on the very early stages of the podcast, but it was high school baseball and that movie had just come out or people knew about it. And they were making fun of me for not having a girlfriend or whatever, you know, like classic high school stuff. And I was really self-conscious in some ways about like feeling a little socially behind or whatever. And they're like, oh, and they're also making fun of how much I cared about sports. And they're like, oh yeah, I can imagine David when he's masturbating being like, for the love of the game, clear the mechanism. And so it stuck with me. It's probably why I remember the movie today.
How have I not heard this before?
I think I did tell you at one point, but maybe you tuned it out too.
No, no, there was no way I would tune that out. Even at mile 27, I'd be like, tell me more.
Oh, high school. Tough time for all of us.
High school was wild. Yeah. I wish I could go back in high school and just give myself a hug.
But the cool thing is like now with the podcast, we have all of the people that we would have loved to hang out with in high school. Listen to the podcast. Isn't that the coolest?
That is true.
Such an honor.
Yeah, it is. It is strange to think about.
Okay, let's get on to news and fun things. We're going to start with a hot water immersion study that just came out. That's really fascinating. So this study is relevant to everybody because type of thing you can think about in your own training. It took 16 people, including 9 males and 7 females, and had a randomized crossover design. So there were 2 30-minute periods that were involved in this design. And so the first 30-minute, so the first trial was exercise plus hot water immersion. The second was exercise plus rest. And the third was hot water plus hot water. So just hot water immersion.
And they had like a 1 week washout period between these. So all of the participants did all of these multiple trials. And then they had a 1 week washout period between all of them. And then it was randomized to like what order that you receive the trials, which is a great way to do science.
Yeah.
But the exercise trials specifically were actually pretty reasonable based exercise. So it was 30 minutes of cycling at 50% of VO2 peak.
So really low energy.
So like pretty low effort, which I think is nice actually, because you can see to what effect heat might have an additive impact in terms of how athletes are recovering from exercise or how athletes are even like physiologically experiencing exercise.
Yeah. And so what's interesting about this to me is we talk a lot about heat on here, and hot water immersion is actually the way I've come to heat train is we have a hot tub, which is great, but hot bath is also wonderful for this. And for me, I find that it just makes me so much better at doing things like avoiding cramps and feeling really good in races when it's hot. And I don't understand exactly why. And I think there's some time still to understand, but here's the money quote from the article. Irrespective of whether hot water immersion preceded exercise or heating, hot water immersion enhanced vascular and blood marker responses while also being more enjoyable than exercise alone.
I love the enjoyment piece, and I love that they looked at that, because you truly, when you go out to your hot tub, you are stoked. I cannot bother you. You take your hot tub time very seriously.
After this podcast, Megan, it's hot tub time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for the first 25 minutes, it's very serious. And then you get in the pain cave and I cannot come out and like bother you. And then as you get out of the hot tub, you just sit on our deck for 5 minutes with your head in your hands, fully processing life. So I feel like it's like part enjoyment, part pain cave. And it's, I like seeing you navigate both of those.
I'm clearing the mechanism.
Yeah, you are.
Well, my head is in my hands for the love of the game, for the love of the hot tub game. Another mention here that, you know, hot water immersion's also been shown to do the same types of blood volume increases and, you know, hemoglobin mass increases that any type of heat training does. So if, you know, warm baths, hot tub, all of this stuff is good. Just make sure it's not too hot. So this was set at 40 degrees Celsius, which I believe is 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the top cap of most hot tubs, which is probably a good thing. Hot baths get as hot as you want them to sometimes if your hot water heater is enough.
Yeah, do not cook yourself.
It is scary shit. Yeah. I have almost died the first time I tried that. Megan almost, you saw me lying on the ground when you came home, worried that I was about to meet my maker. So be careful with that, but it's a great option. You don't need a sauna to get some of these benefits, and it's really good to do year round.
And if you're doing it in a hot bathtub as opposed to like a hot tub, the protocol in this paper was having the water come up to the sternum, and then interestingly, their arms were out.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw that. I don't know why they had the participants' arms out.
I think it's probably just a way to standardize measurements.
Yeah.
Just, I would say have your arms in if you can.
Yeah. You always like having your arms in.
Oh, I want every piece of my body in. I want to be submerged under my mouth and nose. Yeah. I want to become a fish. I want to become just a great white shark in there.
Become one with the hot tub.
Yes. Okay. Let's go on to other news and fun things. Number two, this is the thing we teased at the beginning. It is that time-restricted eating was linked to higher cardiovascular risk. This is, I believe, a poster presentation that is now being, you know, it's getting a lot of mainstream media coverage because the numbers were shockingly large.
Okay, the numbers were shockingly large, but I do think what you said is it's a poster presentation, so this is not published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Yeah.
And as we dive into, the numbers are shockingly large about some of the challenges potentially of time-restricted eating. So in this study, they had participants not eating for 16 hours, which is a pretty long period of time. So like an 8-hour window of eating and then 16 hours of
not eating.
It's like
people that don't eat, just eat from, let's say, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. or whatever. It's a common thing. And honestly, like I never thought it was that big of a deal because I'm like, you know, as long as they're not training a ton, that's probably fine. Whatever the rules they need in their food, whatever.
And perhaps like when you think about, like I would not do this as an athlete because you think about the stress of doing this and the stress of being an athlete. And if the purpose is longevity gains, I think the two of those come together to make a case of like, oh, the longevity gains are actually being thrown out the window.
And whenever we talk about fueling, we're talking to athletes. We're saying fuel the work you're doing, which for athletes is a lot of work. So thus fuel a lot. But I've always been open to the idea that, hey, maybe some of these fitness influencers, hackers, or whatever of bodies that want to talk about things like time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting or whatever. Maybe there's something there that I'm not aware of. I know it's not for athletes, but you know, I'm not talking to non-athletes all
okay,
the time.
But when I saw the title of this paper, I was actually secretly pumped. Does that make me a bad person? I was like, there's a part of me that like doesn't want biohacking to work.
I think it doesn't make you a bad person, but perhaps we should pour some athletic greens out for the people that were negatively affected. So the stats here are that looked at 20,000 people, and it found that those that did 8-hour time-restricted eating had 91% higher cardiovascular risk. That's a big number.
That is a big number. Okay. But the study was conducted terribly. And so I'll be curious to see if this like ever gets published in a peer-reviewed journal. So they used NHANES, which is like a national large survey-based data. I actually used it a lot for like my epidemiology PhD. And in that they had participants doing 2x24-hour food recall surveys.
Yeah.
So it's actually really hard to do that. Like, there's a ton of bias in how you remember food recall. And then they had those surveys, and then they followed them, for the participants, for a median time of 8 years and a maximum time of 17 years.
Yeah.
So over all of these years, they are assessing health outcomes based on two surveys. So, like, think about that. Like, if you took a food survey 8 years ago, how different would it vary from what you're doing right now?
For me?
Yeah.
Oh, you know me. Yeah. I find a new thing every other day. Yeah. So yeah, if they get you on a smart food popcorn day,
I know,
these numbers are gonna be fucked.
Yeah. So there's like tons of variation that happens day to day. And so I think it's actually a very poor way to measure nutritional outcomes.
I also think that maybe the biggest thing here for me is that if someone is doing 8-hour time restricted eating, there's probably an underlying thought process as it relates to food and health, and or rationale for doing it in the first place, that maybe we're for some reason catching at-risk cohorts to begin with.
Well, exactly. And that is the other point, is that there's probably a ton of confounding variables about what are the baseline risk characteristics of someone who chooses this pattern of eating.
Yeah.
And to nutrition research, you have to control for those. And yeah, they didn't in this study. And
yeah, how do you control though? Because it would require such a huge data set with like prospective studies, I imagine.
Yeah, but I guess my point is that I don't think you should publish this research at all if you haven't controlled for the confounding variables that make someone choose a particular type of diet.
Oh, but
maybe the numbers are so large that you could say like, oh, but the stats are so staggering that there must be something there. But I feel like a huge percentage of that is going to be explained by the type of people that select this type of diet.
You know, it doesn't get clicks on Twitter.
What?
Nuance.
That is very
true. This
was
published by the PR team of the American Heart Association. We're not talking about just any publication here. Yeah. But you know, there's a reason it went viral. And I think it's because that number is so large. So I think that at 91%, there probably is some signal that is not just purely correlation rather than causation. It's probably small. It's probably much smaller than that. But I would be careful with things like time-restricted eating for this reason.
Oh, I would be careful with it because it sounds heinous. Yeah. And food is really fun, and smart food popcorn and burgers are fun. But I would be careful with it just because of that rationale and not because I believe this stuff.
Okay. Maybe we can give them those people that had some cardiovascular issues, some athletic greens. Maybe that'll help.
Pour some out for them.
Maybe that'll help. So drinkag1.com/swap, SWAP. We have it every morning. Before race morning, we had a calamity with an early morning Uber driver that didn't get there. And as we were leaving the door, Megan was downing athletic greens. So it's the type of thing that we even swear by on race morning. Definitely has helped out things like our heart rate. So if you're curious, give it a try. If you click, use that site, you get free vitamin D and travel packs. So it's the type of thing that you can try it for a month and cancel if you don't like it, but just do it if you have the spare money for it. It's not the type of thing that you need to break the bank for.
And it's almost like I have this anecdotal evidence for myself that it really helps control my heart rate during activity. So I was hungry for not very many things that morning, though I did force stuff down. But for whatever reason, I could get athletic greens down so easily. I was like, this is the elixir of the performance. Bring it on.
Maybe we could have poured it on the bathroom, on the toilet, like baby powder, and just neutralize the scent. Okay, next up is a really interesting study on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, Aleve, that sort of thing. It's in the Journal of Science and Medicine and Sport, and it's called, very descriptively, NSAIDs do not prevent exercise-induced performance deficits or alleviate muscle soreness. A placebo-controlled, randomized, double-blinded crossover study.
Okay, unlike what we just talked about in terms of time-restricted eating, they pulled out all the research stops. They're like, we're going to randomize this. We're going to double-blind it. We're going to crossover study this. So it was actually great to see how they structured the science to find these results.
It's excessive. If you need to say it in the title, don't say it in the title. It's like, it'd be like on your dating profile being like the absolute best at giving head. It's like, show, don't tell. Come on, study.
I don't know. I respect it. Sometimes I feel like, especially like, I don't know, if you're a profile that's not going to get a lot of clicks, you got to be out there.
Okay.
You got to put yourself, you got to wear it on your sleeve. It's kind of like,
maybe this true swap mentality.
I actually really hesitate. I almost never use the word like Dr. Roach to like describe myself. And I think I need to get more comfortable with that to like respect myself. And studies need to put it on the title.
Be
like,
doctor.
Yo, I did the science right. Yeah.
Double D.
The only double D's I have in my life.
Megan, you're perfect just the way you are.
Yeah. I got like double kindergartens in terms of.
No, because as soon as you put 19 goo roctanes, what do you have then?
Oh, I got.
In your sports bra?
That's so true. But actually, I couldn't wear a pack for this race. I chose to wear a handheld. We had like a long debate about this because.
On Patreon, actually.
Yeah. I felt like the bottles in the front of my pack were making my boobs stretch to infinity and I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, it would be. I'm just saying, like, the alternate universe where your boobs push space and time, yeah, be a pretty cool one. I bet you'd still be going just as fast. Okay, so the study took an NSAID dose 2 hours before, and then the exercise protocol was 10 sets of 10 reps on 40% max leg press. So that's kind of an endurance stimulus, but also quite hard because athletes can leg press a lot of weight. Leg press is one of those machines that you do a lot because, I mean, all day you're carrying around your body weight. So then when you're leg pressing, you're on your back. So you have none of that body weight. So you basically zero is your body weight. And then you go from there. So people are probably doing a pretty good amount of weight, even though it's 40%.
And what they measured, so they had these participants take NSAIDs before exercise. And then they looked at maximum voluntary contraction force, so essentially how the muscles were contracting, vertical jump height, as well as muscle soreness. And they measured these before exercise. And then again at 4 hours and 24 hours post-exercise. And so this comes off a lot of research. And the research is actually much like the nutrition field, where there's like one study that says one thing and then another study that says another thing. And some studies have shown that NSAIDs like limit exercise-induced muscle soreness if taken prophylactically. And then other studies are like, oh, there's no difference. And this study was kind of trying to put another study within that field just to see if there was anything actually there.
And so it found no difference between groups, as you learned from the title, the very, very descriptive title. And I want to find this one. You know, we recommend not taking NSAIDs to any athlete during races.
You're just playing a roulette in terms of like kidney challenges and health risks. And so
it gets back to the health versus performance point, but complicated.
Yes.
I was debating asking you this question, but we're at 115.
Oh, ask me the question.
Okay. So if your life depended on it,
yes.
And you had to win Canyon's 100K, mm-hmm. would you take NSAIDs during the race?
Oh, for sure.
So
I would take them at multiple points during the race. Will I do that? In actuality, no.
No.
Because there's health context. But I do think, and this is actually the challenge, is here in this, we're looking at 10 reps of 40% of max leg press.
Yeah.
And I think the research in this field is so mixed because like this is one form of exercise. There are so many forms of doses of NSAIDs you could take. So like how much like ibuprofen you're taking, and also the type of exercise. Like is running an ultra, is mile 50 fundamentally different than doing leg press? Probably.
Yeah.
And so I think it's actually really hard to isolate in this field. Like what are the true effects? Because there's so many different types of exercise.
And the weird thing is like after a certain point in coaching, you start to see some anecdotes. Like every coach out there has seen anecdotes. Like you probably have also seen people go to the hospital because they've taken NSAIDs during a race. Like,
and it's not worth it.
Yes. It's not worth it. But at the same time, I have seen some international breakthrough performances with athletes that were fading and then took NSAIDs in an aid station. So it's a complicated field. And so we just wanted to flag it because we think there's no reason you should ever take this before an event or prophylactically. And if you hear of athletes having these success stories, we still think it's not worth it. But it points out the complicated nature of science and attributing causation to things that we just don't know, because like there are anecdotes that are probably too real to ignore at this point. But how do you balance that then against the field of literature and the fact that you can never design an ethical study to look at this question in an ultra because the risk of kidney damage is too high?
Well, that by itself, I think, is a reason not to take them. Is it's like true. If we can't actually do a randomized control trial because it's too dangerous, then there's a body of literature that supports that we should not be taking these in races. But I was actually really happy to see the results of this study. Like,
yes, me too.
I think if we found that, okay, NSAIDs were this magical thing for like reducing muscle soreness or for improving performance, it would be this very mixed territory of like, should they be allowed in ultras? Because like, if they're performance enhancing, like proven to be in the scientific research, not just in anecdotes, and they have these health complications, like how do we balance
that? Then we should
that?
Ban them, honestly.
Yes, yeah.
Like, and I kind of liked what UTMB did a few years ago where they banned them.
Yeah.
The problem is
it's complicated though.
There's too many people with health conditions that have to take this stuff for various reasons. Like let's say they have a certain, you know, just there's enough health conditions that involve it that you'd have to be just really handing out TUEs, and TUEs are not handed out willy-nilly. Like it takes so much time and effort to get them that like, I do think there's a place to consider banning these in ultras, or at least more education on why they're bad. But at the same time, understand it's a nuanced field and your personal experience may vary.
And also Tylenol is slightly better. So Tylenol doesn't act through the kidneys. It has more of a like impact in terms of processing in the liver. And so for athletes that are like really struggling with injury or pain or something during a race, Tylenol is always like my go-to first thought.
Or Voltaren.
Or Voltaren.
Voltaren's a topical NSAID. It's like when my knee hurts, I put Voltaren on it before bed. Like it's just a rub, like a topical. So it doesn't get absorbed systemically through the stomach. So lots of options there. Cool science. Wanted to bring it to you. Let's skip that study and get into social media and Strava. So I was listening to interviews with Jonathan Haidt. He came out with a new book. He's a wonderful social psychologist. It's all on the effect of social media on mental health, particularly of young people who have grown up with it. And his big point is that we have seen a hockey stick shaped curve when it comes to negative mental health outcomes, particularly for young girls. And it starts between 2010 and 2012, when the smartphone comes online, the social media networks gather steam, and the front-facing camera becomes common. And it's really scary to see it demonstrated like that. Like, that hockey stick is fucking horrifying. And what it made me think is, like, I don't know if we're thinking quite enough about how athletic social media networks like Strava might also play a role in this. And I just wanted to flag it because I'm worried it could be causing similar issues for young people, especially young women, in ways we're not aware of.
Oh, for sure. And there's actually, I feel like there's a lot less research on Strava compared to something like Instagram or Facebook or Twitter, yeah, in terms of like the mental health challenges. But I think in contrast to like Instagram and Facebook, it's like there's direct metrics of comparison. I mean, there's like totals and images and things like that.
Yeah.
But something about like the direct metric of comparison is so stark on Strava that I'm surprised there's not like a larger body of research looking into, yeah, this. But I also just think, I don't think it's just for the young developing brain. Yeah. Like, I coach athletes in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, where Strava is not healthy for them and their relationship with sport. And I do think like Strava is amazing. Like, we love Strava.
Oh yeah.
My favorite form of social media by far.
I did the most epic upload at the finish line. I don't have, yeah, I don't have auto upload on my Garmin.
Why?
I like to have my training's for me.
Yes. You know. Not all of your training. You have some stealth training. It's not only,
yeah,
Strava.
I'm not training,
yes,
30 miles a week to run that time at Crown King Scramble. That'd, yeah, be pretty cool. I think sometimes I'm able to go under the radar because of that, and I get to races and people are like, oh, okay. But you know, at the finish line, you for some reason cannot download a GPX file from the Garmin Connect app. So I had to go to an incognito window on Chrome, get to the browser, and do all this really complicated thing to get on Strava. But I did.
Meanwhile, I was cramping and baby wrangling, yeah, and you were like trying to do this complicated stuff with Strava. I was like, I need your help.
But, you know, I do think that it's hard because like, I wonder if there are these mental health impacts that people are not comfortable talking about. And because researchers aren't measuring them, we're not talking about them, people are having more negative experiences because they're living their lives through a social media app. Mm-hmm. Because running is such a big part of their lives in the same way that Instagram might be for a high school junior or whatever. So I wouldn't defy it. I think based on this research, I mean, do you think that there might be a differential effect between women and men?
Oh, I for sure see that in coaching.
Yeah.
I think for whatever reason, I think women are more prone to playing the comparison game.
Yeah.
And I don't know why.
Maybe societal.
Maybe societal. Yeah. I'm not entirely sure why that is, but it is a big problem for my female athletes. And I think for what I tell athletes is like, if you're going to use Strava, you have to have clear boundaries in terms of how you use it and how it relates to your relationship with sport. And so like, you know, I think there's helpful research, there's helpful, yeah, learning that can be done on there, but like, you know, if you're not getting good feelings from comparison, just don't do it.
Pay attention, yes, to your feelings.
Yes. Yeah.
I think the difference, let's say, between Instagram for high schoolers and Strava for runners is, I think like, so the big idea for Instagram, one of the crazy things that Jonathan Haidt talked about was that if you ask people, kids, do you want to have these apps deleted forever? They say yes. But if they're not deleted for everyone, everyone needs to be on them and they think it helps them.
It's almost like there's some social
pressure,
some sort of,
yeah, or otherwise you're
social
of,
currency.
You're, yeah, out of it. You, mm-hmm, know, I don't think running should be like that for you. Make sure Strava isn't the means by which you interact with your community. Because that goes down negative paths so quickly for people. So just wanted to flag it. Make sure you pay attention to how these things make you feel. Not just Strava, but literally anything on the internet. Does it make you feel worse about yourself? If so, opt the fuck out sooner rather than later. Because, you know, especially with something like Strava, we're not going to have parents denying us smartphones. Like, we are the ones
that's true,
that are in control of our destiny. Like, Leo is absolutely not going to get a smartphone until he graduates high school. Like, absolutely. Like, the research is insane. I can't imagine what kids now are going through. I'm just so lucky that I didn't have one until law school.
Do you know what's really curious, actually, what? Is that Jasmine Paris has opted out of social media entirely.
Oh, cool.
She has no social media profiles. I don't believe she has a Strava. And I'm interested about, like, yeah, you know, how that relates to, like, what she just did that was, like, so historic and legendary. Is, I'm sure, you know, if she had a social media account, she would still be able to do that. But how she thinks about it and how she contextualized that and how she lives her, like, family and research life, I would love to ask her questions about how that relates and, like, what made her go that path.
Do you think we could get her on the SWAT podcast?
I was just asking you that.
So if you know Jasmine personally, I don't
I mean, know. You know, just ask Damien.
Yeah, I know. I don't want
to. And we're always like, we never want to like, yeah.
So I emailed Jasmine actually a few years ago, talking to her about this opportunity with like a shoe company. It was a big deal. And she wrote back the kindest email you've ever heard. And she essentially said, you know, at this point in my life, like I want to focus on living sustainably and, you know, inspiring through my own actions and stuff like that.
She doesn't have a sponsor. So she co-founded the group Green Runners, which is an environmental advocacy group. So she runs for Green Runners instead of running for a sponsor. And she could make a lot of money running for a sponsor. And I think it's amazing that she opted out of the system altogether and has stood by her core principles. And I'm curious to see, like, when you do something like this that is so legendary, she already has that foundation that exists, but the pressures will be so great is like how she responds to that. Like, I'm sure a shoe company is going to come in and offer her like, you know, a massive contract. And it's like, you know, it's a challenge.
I think she'll
turn it down. Historically she has, so she probably will continue.
So if you know Jasmine and you listen, just put in a kind word. Maybe we'll reach out. Okay. Last little thing from News and Fun Things is from Andy Reid, coach of the Kansas City Chiefs. And there's this wonderful article about football player butts. And I always like to come this time of year. I shouldn't have said I always like to come. Cut myself off at the wrong time. But this time of year, there's a lot of talk about butts because it's the NFL draft season. The NFL draft's coming up. And one of the main things they look at to project athletes is the size of their ass, which I love just because we all need to embrace our own asses. Like, I used to think I had too big of a butt.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah.
You never told me this. Well, your butt's perfect.
I mean,
it just powered you up a big mountain.
But I know that, but it took time to realize that my bubble gives me powers.
At what point did you think this?
Most of my life.
Like last week?
You know, my jokes about childbearing hips or whatever?
Like, yeah.
That's where it comes from. Huh. So Andy Reid was talking to their punter, Dustin Colquitt, and giving him his year-end review. This was when Dustin Colquitt was one of the best punters in the game. And so this is a quote from Dustin. He'd sit down with me and be like, "You went to the Pro Bowl," which is their all-star game, "and we don't have much to say to you, but don't lose your butt. Punters have to have big butts. As soon as you start to look like you're going downhill from a physique standpoint and losing that butt, you're out of here. Keep that ass going."
Keep that ass going. I feel like that actually is so relevant though to ultra and trail runners is looking at Barkley and looking at that race. I wasn't looking at asses, but you have to be strong as shit to do something like that. And if you want to step up to like big adventures and big races, like the version of yourself that's going to perform the best is like a punter.
You can do sidekicks and sit-ups, but please don't lose that butt. My anaconda don't want none unless you do squats. I think I love this too, because I wish that in retrospect, we were going to say like, "We have more lyrics from Tyler Childers' video, In Your Love." And then we were like, "As soon as you start to look like you're going downhill from an ass perspective, you're out of here."
Also, you can just replace ass with poop in this case.
Yeah.
It'll also be very relevant for ultra runners. Biggest skill. You got to own it.
Embrace your ass.
Yes.
Seriously, like 100,000% serious. Like that is, we joke about glute engagement and stuff like that, but I think strong butts are, what the superpower is, and you have to work for strong butts. A lot of us, for me, it comes naturally. I gotta be honest. I was blessed. I was endowed by the creator. But
for me, it's smart food and squats.
Smart food and squats. Perfect. Maybe that should be a title of an episode at some point. All right, let's go on to hot takes to finish off this episode. We're scrolling down past lots of fun things. And this is incredibly relevant. This one just came in this morning from Patreon. Here it is. Continuous glucose monitors are not the most important invention for improving performance. Continuous gluteus monitors will be. Someone please make a device that gives me feedback that I'm engaging those glutes so I can power up those hills on the trails and or push to that PR on the road.
Strong ass monitors. We need more of those.
Yeah. Ass monitors.
Ass monitors in general. I know.
You ever seen those shirts at the beach, which is like... female body inspector or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
FBI female body inspector.
You're like ass inspector.
Ass inspector. It's like AI.
Oh my gosh.
You know how much we're into AI.
I know.
Oh my God. Open ass inspector.
That's amazing.
Sam
OAI.
Altman, CEO. Okay. Last one here. Massage guns are all fun and games until you realize you've been jackhammering a stress fracture for 6 weeks.
Oh shit. Yeah. I'm actually surprised. You really like massage guns. You go down and dirty on massage guns.
I do, but I've never had a bone injury, thankfully.
That's true. Actually, I don't think though, if this is you, don't lament that fact too much, because there's actually, shockwave therapy is a prominent therapy being used for stress fractures and other like other injuries that require significant amounts of recovery. And the way they advertise them is it's basically like a massage gun on steroids. Yeah. And so maybe this person was just shockwaving themselves.
Yeah. Maybe they're ahead of the curve.
Yeah, exactly. The theory of shockwave actually is you get like increased blood flow and it helps improve recovery healing rates.
Oh, interesting. You know, another way to increase blood flow?
What?
Take a machete to your leg. Yeah, lots of blood flow all at once.
All over the place, all over the floor. Do you know they shockwave penises in the case of erectile dysfunction?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wait.
Isn't that wild?
Is it for like a chronic thing? Like, do you shockwave to get some sort of long-term benefit? Or is it like short-term, like kind of like a penis pump or something?
Blood flow benefits. Long-term.
So yes, it improves blood flow more generally.
Blood flow in the long-term.
Huh. Would that be due to like a medical condition? Like how much did you look at this?
Yeah. I mean, it could be due to medical. I mean, there's all types of reasons. Yeah.
But like shockwave responsive treatment. Would that be like, I figure at that point you must have some sort of like blood vessel specific issue.
Yeah. Like, so it's not like psychological. I mean, maybe it would be.
Or even like
I'm sure like if you had psychological erectile dysfunction and you shockwaved it, you'd be like, you'd be really like in the pain cave that maybe it would be much easier. But no, it is for like physiological conditions of reduced blood flow.
Yeah. Could you imagine that doctor comes in with the shockwave? you're standing there and you're like, for the love of the game.
I actually don't know. I don't know if it's sedated. I feel like it should be. That stuff would hurt.
No, I think that would feel quite wonderful, actually. Yeah,
maybe that's the psychological benefits.
Okay, we'll research that more next time. Okay, and on to Listener Corner. Before we do that, do we have anything else that we should plug?
I don't know.
I don't think we do. Thefeed.com/swap.
We love the feed. Yeah.
Make sure you claim reward there. Get your $80. It's the most you can get from any of these benefits. It's free cash, and they are the title sponsor of the podcast. We love the feed. Okay, on to Listener Corner. Listening to the Swap podcast is like doing informational speed work intervals. The rate at which the conversation takes place on this podcast is so fast. It has taken my ears about 6 months to adjust to, with speed work every Tuesday and Friday for approximately 1 hour. I am now able to absorb this training comfortably without taking breaks. Truly, I'm so appreciative for both of you. I out loud laugh so much with this podcast. I will reach for it often before I reach into something like Rich Roll. And that says a lot in my world. Lol.
It's amazing they prevailed.
Yeah.
I wonder what the people think for the first time when they log in and they're like 15 minutes and like, this is a lot. This is rapid fire back and forth about asses.
I swear we don't talk that fast.
I mean, yeah.
Have you ever listened to us on one speed? It is.
But that's because we listen to us on 1.5 speed.
Yeah, to edit.
This is why you do speed intervals, is sometimes you got to run really fast. And then when you're running kind of moderate, you're like, it's comfortable.
Okay, I actually think there's something to this.
Yeah.
This is a serious reflection about listening to things. I think my brain by podcast, and I listen at 1.5 speed, which I think is a pretty common speed to listen to. And maybe our podcast at one speed does this for people that don't like to bump it up. It does improve my rate of processing.
Agreed.
Verbally.
Yes.
And, and in terms of like gathering information. Like I think now I'd be so much better equipped to handle things like law school lectures or med school lectures than I would have been when I was in those places because of podcasts. So I think that this listener is onto something, that there is a way to accelerate your learning monologue. My only concern is, does accelerating your learning monologue accelerate it all the time and also come with some negative consequences?
I was actually just about to ask that. So I would love to do like kind of just like a study on, so in med school, I listened to all my lectures at 1.8 speed, is what is the difference in terms of, I mean, actually, I feel like for me, it was probably very similar retention, but is there like a mental health consequence of that?
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully we're positive enough that it overrides that, but
that's my thing. I'm hoping it's the opposite. So like with med school, you're so bombarded with info.
With facts, and ours is more a vibe.
Vibe. Yes.
Yes.
Exactly. Like you could play our podcast for babies and they'd be like, ha ha ha, I don't understand anything, but that's a vibe I can get behind. So essentially, Megan, we're like Bluey. Again, Bluey always comes up. We're like Bluey, but for adults. What do you think of that?
That's interesting. I've never seen Bluey, so I'm not going to co-sign on that until I know for more.
Wait, you haven't seen Bluey?
I've never seen Bluey.
Okay, I watch it with Leo when you're gone, I guess.
Do you really?
Maybe we're like Sesame Street then. How about that?
Sesame Street is good. Yeah, Sesame Street has bangers. Some of the Sesame Street songs are quite good, actually.
Yeah, they really are. They sometimes bring in pop stars. Like, how did I not know this before I had kids? It's the only like major benefit I've seen of having a kids relative to not.
That's true. Except you are very scared of Elmo.
I am.
Every time we like get near Elmo, I feel like you think that Elmo has some sort of like predatory behavior or something.
Yeah. Would you trust Elmo if you saw Elmo in nature?
Maybe not Elmo's laugh. If I heard that in the forest, I would be like, get me out of this forest. It would break the trance I have in the middle of the race.
Okay, Megan, just imagine I'm in the race on the sidelines, just like, tickle me. What'd you think about that?
That would be, actually, I probably wouldn't even hear it. I'll be like, I'm charging right through.
Okay. Well, we love you. We don't love Elmo, but in fact, maybe for this podcast, maybe that's a bad vibe to end on. maybe we just need to be like, we love you. What's the theme music from Sesame Street?
Oh, sunny days. That's a very high pitch.
Mountain up,
clouds away.
We love you all. Woo-hoo. Huzzah. Tickle me.
Oh, God.